This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What's that you see?
Even if carbon dioxide was not a greenhouse gas, our emissions would seriously damage most of Earth's life. Humans cannot directly see it. It involves science few people have. No industry or even special interest group gains by communicating this threat. Ocean acidification has been called the evil twin of global warming. New science shows ocean acidification has already passed the safety limit set by the Planetary Boundary Framework. We reached a founder in the field, recently retired NOAA Senior Research Scientist, Dr. Richard Feeley. That is coming up. But first, an introduction from biological oceanographer and lead author, Dr. Helen Findlay from the UK's Plymouth Marine Laboratory. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to this in-depth reporting on ocean acidification. Before we start, one tip. We measure how acidic or basic a liquid is using the pH scale, which goes from 1 to 14. Caustic soda, as found in some drain cleaners, is about pH 14, the strongest base or alkali. At the low end, battery acid or sulfuric acid has a pH of 1. pH stands for potential hydrogen. Hydrogen atoms can lose or gain electrons. When a hydrogen atom gains or loses electrons, it is called an ion. In the pH scale of 1 to 14, 7 is considered neutral. Pure distilled water has a pH of 7. As when measuring earthquakes, the scale is not even 1 to 1, it's logarithmic, as they call it. So a change from 8.2 to 8.1 is not small but very large, and from 8.2 to 8.0 is much larger than that, especially when it's applied to the huge volume of the planet's oceans. Okay, here we go.
Radio EcoShock.
Beyond global warming, there's this other thing about fossil fuel burning. We seldom talk about it. Humans are making oceans more acidic. That is not good for tiny life at the bottom of the food chain, or for any of us. A study published in June 2025 finds ocean acidification has gone past the danger point. Professor Helen Findlay specializes in carbon and the sea. Findlay is a biological oceanographer at Plymouth Marine Laboratory in the UK. She leads the paper, Ocean Acidification, Another Planetary Boundary Crossed. From Plymouth, Helen Findlay, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, let's do a little experiment to start. Suppose carbon dioxide was not a greenhouse gas. Humans load up CO2 into the atmosphere, but global warming is not a problem. That CO2 falls into the global oceans. Helen, would that still threaten global life even without warming?
It would, yes, and that's what the problem of ocean acidification is. So the oceans take up that carbon dioxide, and it reacts with the water to form a weak acid. And as it does so, it becomes out of balance with how that natural system would be. And that change in the chemistry can have consequences for marine life that lives there.
And we learned about this as early as 1908 from British geologist John Gregory. He warned that if you add carbon dioxide, you increase carbonic acid in seawater, and that's more acidic. Has there been a steady change of state, more acidification since then, or has the rate of acidification sped up in recent decades?
We believe it's sped up in recent decades. We estimated in the year 2000 that we'd seen about a 30% increase in acidity since pre-industrial times. And then in the last 20 years, that's jumped up to about 40% on a global average. And so it is steadily increasing, and we expect that rate to continue to increase unless we were to curb the CO2 emissions that are going into the atmosphere.
It is hard to believe humans actually changed the atmosphere. It's even hard to believe that gas from our tailpipes can make the whole ocean more acidic. Is that because the marine environment is very sensitive to carbon, or have we just dumped that much new carbon into the sea?
It's a combination. So the ocean and the atmosphere are in a delicate balance with each other, and before humans came along, we had this natural system where they would, the oceans and the atmosphere would more or less be in equilibrium with each other. So there'd be gas coming in and out, and there still is CO2 coming in and out at different parts of the ocean. And it's a delicate balance between the temperature of the ocean and also the different compositions of the ocean. And over geological timescales, so there's long timescales, then that chemistry is also balanced by weathering of rocks. So the addition of calcium and silicate rocks into the ocean balances out that any kind of carbon that gets added from the atmosphere and would change that that carbonic acid. But what humans are doing is adding too much too quickly, and it's that rate of change that we're adding. So the amount of carbon dioxide is not something that's necessarily a problem if we were doing it over geological timescales, but we've done it over 150 to 200 years. And it's adding that huge amount in a very short space of time, which means that the ocean isn't able to keep pace. So there's natural buffering processes, there's natural weathering processes, that natural equilibrium is all out of balance.
What is the planetary boundary when it comes to ocean acidification? How was this determined?
So back in 2009, Johan Rockström and colleagues from the Potsdam Institute decided to come up with this planetary boundaries framework. And they decided that they would have ocean acidification as a representation of the ocean planetary change. And so they decided that something called aragonite saturation state was something that would be useful to look at as the indicator for ocean acidification. Now, aragonite saturation state is related to ocean acidification because when you add the carbon dioxide, it produces carbonic acid. And then the carbonic acid can actually start to sort of erode those calcium carbonate minerals. And the amount of calcium carbonate, whether calcium carbonate minerals form or dissolve in the ocean, is related to the saturation state. So just like when we try and saturate water with sugar, for example, if you just pour loads of sugar into a pot of boiling water, you can add a certain amount and it will dissolve. But once you get past saturation point, then you can't add any more sugar into that system without it actually staying as sugar molecules. So aragonite saturation state is this chemical threshold that tells us when calcium carbonate minerals will theoretically dissolve away or actually become mineral form. And so they decided that the planetary boundaries for aragonite saturation state should be represented by how a certain amount of change from pre-industrial conditions of the global surface ocean. And they decided that it should be about 80% of what it used to be in the pre-industrial. And that boundary was set based on two criteria. They chose the criteria. The first one was to keep the polar oceans from becoming undersaturated. So that boundary of 80% in theory should keep the polar oceans from ever seeing that aragonite saturation state go below 1. And the second criteria was to keep warm water corals, which live in the tropical regions, in what we consider a kind of an environment where they have conditions that allow them to grow well. And there's evidence and research to suggest that an aragonite saturation state of 3.5 or less is starting to be in marginal conditions for growth. And so that was chosen as the threshold.
Aragonite is an amazing substance. It can form into crystals with very beautiful looking rocks, or it's in particles. It goes into animal shells. Why is that a good indicator for what's happening with acidification in the ocean?
Yeah, so aragonite is a really interesting mineral in its own right, but it actually also forms part of many marine organisms that produce calcium carbonate shells use aragonite as opposed to any other calcium carbonate mineral. They do also use other types such as calcite or high magnesium calcite. Aragonite is really common in lots of these creatures, so things like pteropods, which are free-swimming calcifying snails, so they swim around in the ocean. They are also known as sea butterflies because they look like they've kind of got these little wings with their shells on their back. They make their shells out of aragonite, and corals have aragonite in them as well as calcite, and also things like your shellfish, your mussels, clams, oysters, things like that have a combination of aragonite and calcite. And so when you start to get aragonite saturation state dropping, then the minerals are more likely to dissolve. And so if you have exposed calcium carbonate shells or coral structures or skeletons made of aragonite material, and you put them in conditions of lower saturation state, then they're more likely to dissolve away. And so that was the link between ocean acidification and this chemical threshold, if you like, and then the biological response to that.
You quote a 2015 study by the late Will Steffen saying, changes in control variables at the subglobal level can influence functioning at the Earth system level, which indicates the need to define subglobal boundaries that are compatible with global level boundaries definition. I've been sort of trying to get at that for years. Global averages and long-term trends can hide regional differences that themselves alter global systems in significant ways sometimes. Is this realization spreading in science, and how does your team employ it in the new study?
It's a really interesting one. I think it's really important to recognize that global averages hide these nuanced details, and something that I've been aware of my whole research career, I guess, in the sense that we think about ocean acidification and climate change, and we kind of talk about 1 degree or 1.5 degree warming or 2 degree warming or the same for CO2 levels and acidification. And actually, for many regions of the planet, those don't really make a lot of sense because the rates of change or the amount of change that is happening there is either faster or slower or greater. I do a lot of work in the Arctic region, and so it was through discussions with my Arctic colleagues and thinking about talking to policymakers that we've been doing with Arctic community that actually that first criteria that was set for the planetary boundary of acidification, of not allowing the polar regions to become undersaturated, just isn't true. So it doesn't hold at all, because we know that we have evidence that the Arctic Ocean, for example, already experiences seasonal, if not regional, annual periods of undersaturation in the surface ocean today, and actually historically. And there's evidence to suggest that even pre-industrially, there were some places in the Arctic Ocean which would have experienced undersaturated conditions. And so you start to sort of think about how can you have a criteria for a boundary which is based on a regional assumption, but you're using a global average. And actually, the same is true for the corals. There's different things happening in these different regions that mean that the change is faster in one region versus the other. So the rate of acidification is much faster in the Arctic Ocean, in the polar regions, than it is in the tropics. But actually, there's processes in the tropics that mean that the second criteria also doesn't necessarily hold if you start to go into those regional differences. And so that's what we wanted to try and bring into this paper, was can we get at those regional differences by taking a view of what's going on in those sort of seven regional ocean basins, and thinking about using the same kind of criteria. If we've got pre-industrial value and then, say, an 80% change, let's look at what that pre-industrial value was for that region and think about how that's changed specifically in that region moving forward to today, and also relative to that boundary. And then setting kind of a new boundary, if you like, as to where certain criteria do or do not get crossed or kind of actually make more sense. And so we concluded that the Arctic Ocean, because of this kind of, in pre-industrial times, you would maybe expect to get about 5% of the surface ocean of the Arctic to be undersaturated on a seasonal time frame, that it was maybe a better option to set the criteria for the boundary as something that keeps a certain proportion of that Arctic Ocean undersaturated, rather than kind of just saying this global average condition, and looking at what that global average then would be if to allow maybe just 10% of the Arctic Ocean to become undersaturated, or what would it be if you stuck to that pre-industrial value of just 5% of the application? And the same for the corals, as another example. The warm water corals, to keep all of the warm water corals in conditions where the marginal growth, let's say aragonite saturation state, is above 3.5, you actually have to have a boundary of about 15% change from pre-industrial conditions rather than the 20%, or sorry, like 85% rather than 80% reduction from pre-industrial conditions. And so you can start to piece together, by looking at those regional differences and regional changes, what that would mean for where the global average should sit. So that's what we tried to do in this paper.
There is an assumption that marine species will move toward the poles as ocean conditions around them become too hot. But what if the second prerequisite for the base of the food web, acidity, is already changed in polar waters before that relocating creatures could happen?
It's a concern. So we know that we're already seeing some shifts towards the poles by different groups of organisms and creatures. But what we would predict to happen with ocean acidification is a kind of a squeezing effect. You'll get different species that will be susceptible to different amounts of acidification versus temperature. Some will be less sensitive and more sensitive to warming, whereas others will be more sensitive maybe to acidification. And that's a complicated situation that we haven't quite figured out yet, I don't think. But we do understand, and I think there's some evidence of it happening, or it will start to appear in our systems, of this squeezing effect where you won't be able to get some species moving northwards or towards the poles, because the rate of acidification means that the environment that they're moving into is not going to be sufficiently, it's not going to have the conditions that they require to survive for ocean acidification. So something like the pteropods, for example, we know that they are really important Arctic species, but actually they're a global species, and so we would maybe expect some of the southern populations to move further north into the Arctic space. We would expect the Arctic ones to be detrimentally impacted by acidification, and we're already seeing evidence of that. But the ones moving north, because of temperature changes, are probably then going to find this issue of acidification is too much for them to survive there as well.
So when it comes to die-offs of tropical coral, the news always reports the impact of heat, often a marine heat wave leading to bleaching. But I wonder, is the background of continuing withdrawal of easily available carbon due to acidification also a factor in these mass coral death events?
For coral reefs, warming is going to still be the major issue. What is likely to happen, and is what is shown in, there's natural CO2 vent sites, so they're a really good analogue for what the future might look like if we were to carry on emitting carbon dioxide. And you can see in those situations where you have bleaching still happening because of warming, but actually the coral is kind of being eroded away underneath that. So the problem we have with something like coral is that temperature is going to be the dominant driver of bleaching and the effects. There's no clear evidence. There's a bit of a mixed. There's a few studies that suggest that acidification amplifies it. There's a few that say it doesn't. So it's a bit mixed in terms of the actual bleaching effect. But once you have a bleached coral, it no longer has its food supply. So it uses the things that make it colourful are the zooxanthellae, the tiny microscopic organisms that are living on that coral, that provide the coral itself with its food. And so once you take away essentially the ability for that coral to have a good food source, a healthy food source, then you're taking away an energy source for that coral. And so it's less capable of fighting off or being resilient to other stresses like acidification. It's also then exposed coral, it's exposed skeleton, and so that exposed skeleton is more likely to be eroded more rapidly by things like acidification, and the changes in the chemistry are more likely to have an impact on the organism itself, because it doesn't have this energy that it can use to kind of fight off those changes, which we know can happen. So we know that if you have an organism and you put it into kind of a future acidified conditions, but you give it loads of food, then actually generally they do okay. They can kind of overcome that energetic cost of acidification. But leaching effects will make that more difficult for coral to survive moving forward.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Helen Findlay, lead author of the new paper, Ocean Acidification, Another Planetary Boundary Cross. You find if humanity chooses the lowest emissions pathway, some parts of the ocean continue to be livable for species sensitive to acidification. But we are currently on at least the middle pathway, the SSP 2 to 4.5, maybe on the worst, higher than that. Will ocean safe zones for acidities survive by the end of this century on our current pathway?
So I'm ever an optimist. I like to think that we can turn things around. So yes, we are currently on a trajectory of the middle road. The modelers are actually not really modeling the worst case scenario anymore because we're not on that tract, but we are still on the high tract of the middle. And I think that is concerning. But there will still be areas of the ocean that are less affected by acidification. One of the things that we try and do at PML, I have colleague Anna Quiros and her team have been looking at how we can think about climate smart spatial planning and marine conservations and thinking about marine protected areas. And the thing we want to do there is make sure that we use the best available models and information to be able to predict how acidification and warming and lots of these other stresses come together to find out where areas are least affected and most affected. And then we can effectively plan our conservation efforts to really be able to support those areas that are least likely to be affected, so that we can kind of protect areas of biodiversity, but also maybe we can manage other areas that are going to be affected by multiple drivers of change, that maybe we can have a local concerted effort where we don't put so much fishing, for example, so that takes away one of the stresses that we can have a bit more control over. So it's difficult, but I believe there will still be, the ocean's still going to find a way. Things will still survive. For example, the algae that will and plants and seaweeds will be okay. And there's a chance, in some respects, that the growth of those phytoplankton and algae and things will actually start to kind of take up more carbon dioxide and try and balance things out a little bit. So nature has a funny way of surprising us sometimes. But I think we do have to help nature along. We've made this issue, and I think it's up to us to really try and help sort it out by reducing CO2 emissions as much as possible.
It is easier for our brains to picture the ocean like a map of its surface. It's more difficult to imagine three dimensions with layers of depth acting differently. Tell us about your adventure adding the global subsurface to our understanding of acidification.
Yeah, I think it's really easy, as you say, to think of the ocean as just a flat plane. We do that with the land. We're very used to just being on one flat, well, not flat, but just one plane of land where we kind of see the earth and that's it. But I hope that your listeners have had the opportunity to watch films and documentaries where you get submarines and people going down into the deep ocean, whether it's for these kind of horror stories about what might live down there, or it might be just scientific curiosity about what might be down there. But the ocean is 3D, and we have to remember that. It's all about what is below the surface. And most of the organisms and creatures that live in the ocean live below the surface. And I think it's really important for us to try and remember that. And if you speak to fishermen or even the coral reef, like, you have to go diving or at least snorkeling and dive down to see those. So again, we're just kind of touching the top of that living space by being on the surface of the ocean, and there's so much more beyond that. So we really wanted to recognize that in the planetary boundaries, and even our attempt at doing that really only took us to about 200 meters down in the water column. But what we wanted to show that ocean acidification isn't just a surface ocean issue. It's actually happening throughout the whole ocean. And in some areas, the rates of acidification are actually faster in those deeper layers of the ocean. And that's because of the way that the ocean circulates. And that's really important for kind of taking nutrients and carbon around our planet and oxygen and supporting life. So the nutrients that come up from the deep ocean into the upwelling zones on the coasts of the west coast of North America and South America and places like that, they have huge amounts of nutrients. And so those nutrients come to the surface, and that's really important for fisheries systems. But actually, that nutrient-rich water is also full of carbon because of the carbon going down into the deep ocean and being respired and coming back up as CO2. And so we know that there's areas of the ocean where those processes happen, and they can impact the surface, but they can also just be impacting the organisms that live there. And one of the research things, projects I was interested in probably about a decade ago was cold water corals. And we have colleagues up in Edinburgh and many other places around the world that have continued to study cold water corals and the impacts of acidification. And they live maybe down at from sort of 500 to 1,000 meters deep. And these coral, huge cold water coral systems, likened to sort of the Great Barrier Reef sort of in scale, but we just don't know that they're there because we don't see them every day. But they're hugely important for fish reef building and for nursery grounds for fish. And those will be impacted by acidification coming up from the deep, kind of as because of that ocean circulation, bringing that carbon down into the deep ocean and then that becoming remineralized into CO2 again and causing acidification in the deep ocean. And so that's why we wanted to kind of try and recognize at least part of that in this planetary boundaries paper.
Yes, you and your colleagues lay out an important list of benefits for living things. If we can limit a pH decline to just 10% of ocean levels in pre-industrial times, that's a new, more sensitive barrier and boundary you're suggesting. Have we already crossed that boundary? And if so, what then?
Yeah, so the 10% boundary makes sense in terms of what we would consider a precautionary threshold or boundary. But yeah, unfortunately, we have passed that. If you look at the data that we have and the models suggest that we probably passed that about in the year 2000 or between 2000 and 2010 on a global average, that's where we need to be going back to. And it's a difficult thing to get back to, like all the boundaries in the planetary boundaries framework. Of all nine of them, I think we've now crossed seven. And it's going to take some substantial effort to get back to the safe zone for all of those, and ocean acidification is no exception. I think what was important for us was recognizing that acidification is already in what we would consider, as researchers having studied this for over 20 years really, is this community is concerned that acidification is already moving into an unsafe space. And so to be able to get that recognition and to motivate people to act more rapidly perhaps, or in more determinedly to ramp up our efforts, then we need to recognize that we've crossed a boundary and we're moving into that unsafe space. And the more further we go, the more difficult it is to get back. But I'm an optimist, and I really do believe that we have the opportunity to get back to that value, but we just have to have a collective effort and motivation to do that.
We have regular climate conferences without a lot of success, but are there regular conferences and reports on ocean acidification? How about activist groups?
In terms of scientific reports, what we've tried to do is to bring oceans and ocean acidification into those climate discussions, so those annual conferences. It's taken a while, certainly at the high level, to get that recognition, but something that I think is less easy to argue about with ocean acidification is its direct cause of global carbon dioxide emissions. And as you sort of started off this conversation by saying, even if carbon dioxide emissions weren't a greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide is causing ocean acidification. And so that's a really important message for policymakers. And so we've tried really hard, colleagues of mine before I was on the scene, to get oceans recognised in the climate discussions and to get ocean acidification recognised and discussed. And I think it's coming forward. We have had opportunities to include it, and it's now recognised by the World Meteorological Organization as one of their indicators. It's also recognised by the Sustainable Development Goals. Under the Ocean Sustainable Development Goal, it has its own indicator. And in the latest biodiversity discussions, it's now recognised as an indicator for biodiversity targets as well. So it is getting more recognised. With respect to groups that are kind of lobbyists or that are kind of activists, I'm not aware of many that specialise in kind of the ocean acidification issue as their core motivation for being an activist in this space. But increasingly, interestingly, I am getting more questions from the general public that have come across this issue and are concerned. In fact, in the last 2 months, I've had three school children letting me know that they're doing projects on ocean acidification, and could I comment on a couple of their questions that they had. And so I do think the message is getting out there, and we just need to kind of keep that message going, and hopefully we'll move in the right direction.
From Plymouth Marine Laboratory, we've been speaking with biological oceanographer Dr. Helen Findlay. She leads the paper Ocean Acidification, Another Planetary Boundary Crossed. Find links and notes to follow up in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Helen, thank you for sharing all this with our listeners.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You want to understand ocean acidification? Here is an expert's expert. Richard A. Feeley is an American chemical oceanographer, gaining his doctorate in 1974. From 2008 until his recent retirement, Dr. Feeley was senior research scientist at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory. Among over 160 published studies, Dr. Feeley is second author on the June 2025 paper, Ocean Acidification, Another Planetary Boundary Crossed. From Washington State, Dick Feeley, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Is ocean acidification just another side story to climate change, or is it a major impact of industrialized humans?
Well, the root cause of climate change and the root cause of ocean acidification are the same thing. As we burn fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, and CO2 goes into the atmosphere, and over 2 trillion tons of CO2 have gone in the atmosphere since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And about 25% of that, or about 550 billion tons of CO2, has been taken up by the oceans over the past 250 years. And that acidification causes a decrease in the ocean pH, and that's why we call it acidification. And since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we've seen a decrease in surface ocean pH of about 0.1 pH units. Now, pH is on a log scale, and so that represents an increase in the hydrogen ion concentration, which causes the acidification, of about 30% since the pre-industrial period. So it's really a very large change that has taken place over the last 250 years.
Right. It's reported as a rather small decimal change in pH, like the global average is 8.1 compared to 8.2 before the Industrial Revolution. But as you say, it's a log scale. So like earthquakes, a 6.5 earthquake is a lot bigger than a 6 point earthquake. It's a little hard, though, for the public to grasp such small numbers being a big event.
Yeah, it is, but with respect to the way the evolution of the oceans have taken place over the Earth's history, this is a very, very rapid change. In fact, it's many times greater than anything we've ever seen in the past, as much as 10 to 100 times greater.
As you discovered working with shellfish farmers in the Pacific Northwest, anything that makes shells can be damaged by ocean acidification. And if those shells don't form, including in the billions of plankton that also make shells, then less carbon ends up captured on the seafloor. Can we see a feedback from ocean acidification to more climate change and back to more acidic sea? Are there climate feedbacks at work here?
Yes, there are, and you kind of hinted as how that works. So when CO2 is taken up in the oceans, part of it quickly gets taken up into phytoplankton and zooplankton and the shells of calcifying organisms, which are zooplanktonic themselves. These are tiny shells of things like pteropods or forams. And that carbon that's taken up then sinks to the bottom of the ocean when the animal dies. And if the rate of change of CO2 is large enough, then we see that those animals don't build their shells. They don't calcify. So less carbon is settles to the seafloor. And over time, you can see the changes in calcification that has taken place. And so that indicates that we're getting a climate feedback from the amount of CO2 that enters the ocean and the impacts on the biological system.
Well, let's dive into something called the ocean carbon saturation state. What is that? And please introduce us to the three main states of carbonate levels from super to under saturation.
Sure. So in the surface ocean, the oceans are usually saturated with respect to calcium carbonate. That means there's plenty of calcium and carbonate ions in order for the organism to produce the shells or skeletons. And as long as the saturation state is greater than 1, then the organism can produce its shell. When the saturation state gets to a value of 1, that means that it's at equilibrium and the animal will have more difficulty forming its shell or skeleton. When it gets below 1, the shells actually begin to dissolve. And we actually see this in the oceans everywhere where we look to see when that saturation state is close to the surface where their animals are living. And here in the Pacific Northwest, that saturation state is very, very close to the surface in near shore waters in the North Pacific. And in the open oceans, it's usually somewhere around 100 meters or so. So it's very much involved in that biological cycle where animals are forming their shells and has a very measurable impact on the dissolution of the shells of the organism. And once the organism begins to have its shell dissolved, it has to focus more energy on rebuilding its shell, which means it makes it harder for them to grow and reproduce and have a normal life cycle. And so we see these organisms are under tremendous stress right now. As that saturation state gets closer and closer to the surface, when you add more and more CO2 to the water, the saturation state itself decreases until it gets to a value below 1. And that's my job for the Pacific Northwest, is measure those changes and how rapidly they're changing and how closely they are getting to the surface. In the Pacific Northwest, along the Washington, Oregon coast, for example, they can get as close as 20 meters from the surface. So seriously impacting the ocean ecosystem and the organisms that depend on that, such as oysters and crabs and other shellfish that we tend to utilize for food.
It seems a little paradoxical. I mean, you would think more carbon going into the sea would mean more carbon available for the shell-forming things, but it sounds like they have to work 3 jobs just to get the carbon they used to get more easily.
Well, the organism itself is looking for its chemical species called carbonate, And carbonate is, you know, there's carbonate, bicarbonate, and dissolved CO2. As you add in more CO2 from air-sea exchange, CO2 across the atmosphere into the oceans, the carbonate concentration decreases, and it's forming more bicarbonate instead of carbonate. And so as that carbonate concentration decreases, the organism has a more difficult time forming a shell or skeleton. And at a certain point where the saturation state gets lower than 1, then that shell begins to dissolve. And you'll see pitting of the shell. And in some cases, for example, in the Salish Sea where it's so bad, you can actually see holes in the shell. So very significant impacts that we see because of acidification.
Why is it urgent to prevent polar oceans from reaching undersaturation, and where does that stand?
Well, the polar oceans themselves are, as everybody knows, much colder than the tropical regions. And it turns out that in colder water, more CO2 can go across the air-sea interface, and then that will decrease the carbonate ion concentration. So it's a function of temperature. And so at those very low temperatures in the polar seas, the saturation state is much closer to 1 initially. Generally speaking, it's about 1.2 or 1.5, somewhere in that area. So it doesn't take much of an increase in CO2 to cause that saturation state to get below 1. And therefore, the polar oceans, we see the most serious impact of ocean acidification.
So as species decline in inhospitable conditions, they also become less able to adapt to the changes we're throwing at them. How does a shift in ocean acidity end up weakening the gene pool?
Well, I'm not sure we are far along with the research to say what the total impacts on the gene pool. What we do know is that the combined stress of increased temperature and acidification together affects the distribution of certain key species in the oceans that affect the entire ecosystem. For example, it has an enormous impact on calcifying organisms like pteropods that are food for salmon and other key species that we care about. And as the pteropods sometimes go away from a region that's severely impacted by temperature acidification, then we do see impacts on the upper part of the ecosystem. So we're just getting to establish those relationships now. When the waters get cooler or things get back to normal from these hot spots, then the pteropods return because they come from other regions where they're less well impacted into the region. So right now, we see a receding of areas that are severely impacted fairly quickly. But if you continue to increase the CO2 in the atmosphere, then those hotspots will continue to grow, and there will be more serious impacts on those ecosystems.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Richard Feely, recently retired senior research scientist at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory. That's in Washington State. Going back to a PNAS study in 2007, you found other combustion and agricultural byproducts also add to marine acidity. Tell us about nitrogen and sulfur deposition and their impact on ocean acidification.
CO2 is an acid gas, so it reacts with water to form carbonic acid. So other species, nitrogen and sulfur species, also form acid gases. Sulfate goes to H2SO4, for example. And nitrogen can end up in seawater as nitrates. And so they can either impact them directly because increased acidification in coastal waters, or they can have an impact of enhancing the productivity of the waters. And when you enhance the productivity, then there's more enrichment in carbon in phytoplankton. But that phytoplankton will settle down to deeper depths and be remineralized back to CO2. So in coastal waters, you get an enhanced acidification effect called coastal acidification. because of the combined effect of the anthropogenic CO2 from the atmosphere and the respiration signal you get from decomposing phytoplankton, and that enhances the acidification process. And in subsurface waters, in many of our coastal waters, for example, the rate of acidification is actually higher in subsurface waters than it is in surface waters. And you see that in the open ocean as well. And it's all these combined effects that we're just beginning to understand how they interact and enhance the acidification process.
Carbon capture by the oceans acts as a buffer to climate change. Can this buffer fill up, and what is the Revel factor?
Okay, so the Revel factor is a number that we keep track of when we do our measurements of the carbon system in the ocean, because that tells us how much the oceans can absorb more CO2 from the atmosphere. And as the Revel factor increases, the buffer capacity decreases, a direct relationship. So the higher the Revel factor, less ability the oceans have to take up CO2, and so therefore there's more rapid change in pH and pCO2 of the water, which means that as that buffer capacity is decreasing, we're seeing a higher rate of increase of the hydrogen ion concentration in the pCO2, and we see that in the subsurface waters. And so it has a huge impact. So we have to keep track of how that buffer capacity is changing over time. That becomes very important because the speciation of carbonate ion versus pH versus bicarbonate is all a function of that buffer capacity. And so, as I said, when that buffer capacity decreases, you see much more rapid change in pCO2 and much more rapid change in hydrogen ion concentration, to the point where it can be 2 to 3 times higher concentration changes occurring in subsurface waters compared to surface waters.
Yes, I was going to ask you about the rate of change in ocean acidification. I mean, in a 2009 study, you found our carbon dioxide emissions in the year 2008 were about 10 billion tons. Since 2008, human carbon emissions have almost tripled, reaching a record high of 37 billion metric tons in 2023. Did world oceans react to this rapid change in the atmosphere in the last couple of decades?
That's a very important question that many of the scientists are concerned about and worried about. Is the oceans keeping up with the atmosphere? Because there's such a remarkable change in the atmosphere. Is the oceans keeping up? And so we have an international program called GOSHIP, where we monitor the CO2 concentrations throughout all the worlds. There's 14 different countries that have participated in this study. And what we have been doing is we've been monitoring the changing concentration of carbonate system every single decade now for the past 4 or 5 decades. And what we have seen is that for the most part, the oceans have been keeping up with the atmosphere. The percentage of the atmospheric CO2 that enters the ocean, about 25%, has maintained itself. Until recently, there's been some studies that there are some locations in the oceans now where it seems to be slowing down a bit, that it's not reaching its capacity, but just slowing down in its ability to absorb more CO2. And we're just beginning to see those effects right now. There's just about 2 or 3 papers that have identified this. And that's why the scientists are very concerned about, will the oceans continue to do their job? Because, you know, if it wasn't for the oceans, the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere would be, you know, much higher than it is right now. And global temperatures would be higher by about half degree C. So it's major impact that we would be seeing if there is rapid changes in the way the ocean can take up that CO2.
Melting glaciers are adding so much fresh water that sea levels are rising. New science suggests more rain may be falling over the sea. Could the addition of extra fresh water weaken or dilute acidification?
Well, in the Arctic Ocean, we're seeing a lot of increase precipitation and melting of sea ice. And it's very interesting to the chemists, because when sea ice melts, it causes a very enhanced acidification, two to five times faster in the Arctic Ocean near the ice melting regions than in the global oceans as a whole. So that melting sea ice plays a major role in acidification. And we see it very clearly in the Arctic Ocean, and we're beginning to see it in the Antarctic Ocean. So we're keeping a close eye on how things are changing in both those regions.
As you know, banks and governments are committed to more gigantic projects to extract more fossil fuels in coming decades. If we continue on this path, what does the best science suggest will happen to ocean pH by the end of this century, just 75 years from now?
Yeah, there's been a number of models that have projected out to the end of the century on how pH would change. And our best estimates right now, of course, depend on what CO2 emission scenario you put forward towards the end of the century. But our best guess right now is that from the pre-industrial period to the end of the century, the pH change could be as much as 0.3 or 0.4, in that range, between 0.3 and 0.4, which would be between 100 and 150% increase in the hydrogen ion concentration. So the acidity would increase by that much. And the projection, the economic projections are that would have a significant impact on our shellfish industry, in particular, causing a loss of shellfish resources, or total fish resources, of approximately as much as $500 billion per year in fishing resources that may occur because of these changes. In terms of protein sources for humans and our fisheries, this is a major issue.
Can we reverse it, bringing world oceans back into the chemical zone best for current plants and animals? Can we, for example, dump a bunch of alkaline substances in there, like geoengineering?
Well, the best way to avert these changes that we're seeing right now is to do as best job we can is reduce CO2 emissions that get into the atmosphere in the first place. And so all the efforts that the scientists through the Paris Accords have suggested that we need to increase our efforts to reduce CO2 emissions. That's by far the most important solution that we have. There are other approaches that are being tested right now that would add alkalinity to seawater or to enhance the biological productivity, for example, by adding iron or other nutrients. A number of different ways to ensure that carbon is being taken up in the surface ocean and delivered to depths more rapidly. Studies are very preliminary right now, but they're going on in many, many countries for a variety of different approaches. But we're finding that the scaling factor for these kinds of studies is quite enormous. In other words, yes, we can do an experiment in the field. We can show a dramatic change in alkalinity near the point of injection. But the ability to scale this up over the long term is going to be an enormous challenge.
Since 1974, you authored and co-authored over 150 works on ocean chemistry. What drew you to this problem of acidification so many decades ago?
Oh, actually, we had been working on the ocean carbon sources and sinks probably a decade before we started any research on ocean acidification. And so in 2004, we had finally amassed enough data to show the global distribution of anthropogenic carbon in the oceans. And that was done by a colleague of mine, Chris Sabine, who worked with me at PMEL. So we had the first global distribution of anthropogenic CO2. That was published in Science in 2004. And at that same time, he and I were close colleagues. I said, well, I'd like to write an additional paper, a companion paper, if you will, on the impact of that anthropogenic CO2 globally on the acidification of the oceans. So we had a joint paper, a companion paper, and both papers were published in Science 2004 showing the global impacts of acidification. That was the first time that we showed this to have such an enormous impact globally.
So it's a relatively new problem. It's no wonder that oceans, that the public doesn't really understand it. I mean, we can't just tell the difference by sticking our hand in the sea. I wonder, can we get voters and workers and leaders to care about this? What are your thoughts?
Over the past several decades, we've done an enormous job of conveying this information. You know, we started from that paper in 2004, and since then we've gotten the field of ocean acidification addressed in the IPCC, Intergovernmental Program on Climate Change, reports and addressed it in the United Nations and addressed it throughout the world. So communicating that throughout the world has really taken off and really has been received internationally as a very important study. There's many, many collective research efforts that have been going on between the United States and Europe and Australia and Japan, China. So collectively, we've done a good job of communicating its impacts. We have a global ocean acidification network called GOON, and that network combines all the research that people are doing throughout all the countries, making sure all the data are assimilated and preserved in the national databases. And we are really clearly showing the overall global impacts of acidification. So from a scientific perspective, we have made great progress. From a communication perspective, I think acidification is certainly highly important. It's just that it's in this day and age, it's a little bit harder to communicate this one problem compared to all the other global issues that we're dealing with. And I think therefore it's just one amongst many problems that we're dealing with. Climate change, for example, has such an enormous impact on agriculture and food resources. And acidification combined with climate change has the same kind of impact on marine ecosystems and marine food sources. So we try and connect the two as much as we can together because they have the same cause. And doing so, we begin to communicate the overall impacts that climate change is having on our ecosystems and on humanity.
From Washington State, we've been speaking with one of the best experts in ocean acidification, former NOAA senior research scientist Dr. Richard Feeley. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dick, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I enjoyed it immensely.
Are you wondering how a gas in the air can turn the whole ocean too sour for billions of living things? Next week, we complete this series on ocean acidification with the chemist's view, the nitty-gritty of how all this works, with Dr. Bruce Gibb from Tulane University in New Orleans. One last passing of note, the whole damn library of NASA research. The Trump administration announced it closed NASA's giant collection, tens of thousands of books, documents, and journals, as of January 2nd, 2026. According to the New York Times, Jacob Richmond, a NASA spokesman, said the agency would review the library's holdings over the next 60 days, and some material would be stored in a government warehouse, while the rest would be tossed away. Famous climatologist Michael Mann responded, "Not since the ransacking of the Library of Alexandria have we witnessed such a wanton, intentional assault on scientific knowledge."